We find ourselves during time of the year where we read the Parshiot of Shmot, Bo, Bishalach, the story of the Jewish people's time as slaves when they're in Mitzrayim and their experience as they move toward Geulah, as they move toward redemption and leaving Mitzrayim. And this is a theme, obviously, that we focus on Pesach, at the Seder, throughout the Chag of Pesach in general. But it is also something that we can focus on each and every day of the year in our own lives in one big way, which we're going to talk about this evening. So the title of this discussion is Free at Last, Jewish Greats Reflect on Freedom. And we're going to look at three different Jewish thinkers from the last generation. Natan Sharansky is still alive, so he's still in our generation. But Rav Kook, who lived close to 100 years ago, Viktor Frankl, who is more recent in history, we'll tell you a little bit more about him soon. And each of these thinkers went through different experiences in their lives that impacted them to think a little bit about what does it mean to be free? What does it mean to be free in the Jewish sense and in our own lives? So we're going to begin with Sefer Shmot. Sefer Shmot, the beginning of the story, the Jewish people find themselves in Egypt after Yosef comes down to Mitzrayim with his brothers and his family, after he went to get his father to bring them down, and they're living there for quite a bit of time before they become slaves. They're just living in Egypt. Very nice life. They're given very nice accommodations where they live. They have jobs, there's job security, there's good economy, things are going well for the Jews. And then we have Vayakom Melech Hadash, as you all studied in the book of Shemot, Vayakom Melech Hadash, Mitzrayim, Asher Lo Yadat Yosef, there's a new king, there's a new pharaoh, there's somebody new in charge, and he basically erases all the history that had been before, that there was a Jewish existence in Mitzrayim before, and there's a new boss in town, and he is not fond of the Jewish people. He's not fond of the fact that the Jewish people are growing in number, and that they're taking over, and he's worried, as we know the story in Shemot Perek Aleph, he's worried that what's going to happen, the Jews are going to grow too big, too large, and they're going to take over. And they're going to try to maybe topple the government, or something of that nature. So he devises this plan to enslave the Jews, to murder the Jews. Some commentaries say, the Ramban is of this opinion, that Paro's plan was never to enslave the Jews at all. His plan was genocide. First person in history to have a plan to eliminate the Jewish people off the face of this earth. He wasn't successful. They end up in slavery. They're in slavery for a very long time. Generations of Jews are in slavery. Parents, grandparents, grandchildren. To the point that if you were a slave in Egypt, if any one of us was a slave in Egypt, you would have already been, and you were of the generation that's leaving Egypt, you would have been in a family that had been slaves for over 80 years. So for you to even remember a time, or your parents to remember a time when they weren't slaves, would probably be very hard. You might have to speak to the grandparents or the great-grandparents. What happens in a society like this, what happens in a time like this, is people lose their identity. People lose their sense of shame, of name, of being, of purpose, of mission, of ideals, of values. And that's symbolized most strongly in chapter 2, in Perek Bet of the book of Shemot. Now, if you just look at the first page that's in front of you, what you'll notice in this story, if you've never noticed it before, everybody look at that page and just pay attention to the way people are described in this story. They're described as people with relationships, but without any names. For example, Pasuk Aleph, Vayelech Ish mi Beit Levi, Vayikacha Beit Levi. The English is on the bottom half. Certain man of the house of Levi went and married a Levi woman. Who are these people? We don't know who they are. Rashi tells us, other commentaries, they give names to these people, but they're not given names in the story. And it goes on. So we have a nameless man from the house of Levi, a nameless woman from the house of Levi. We have a woman who gives birth to a boy. No names. And then she can't hide him any longer after 3 months, and she puts him in a teva, and he goes down the river, Pasuk Gimel, Pasuk Dalet. The sister, who's the sister? She doesn't have a name either. She's standing from afar to look, what's going to happen, what's going to be with this baby, with this child. And then there's Bat Paro, the daughter of Paro. Does she have a name? Pasuk Hey? She probably does, but it's not given here in the Psukim. She goes down to bathe herself in the Nile River. Na'aro Teha, who are these people? They're people that work with her, for her. They don't have any names either. She sees the Teva, she brings it in, she sends her servant to bring the Teva in, she opens it, there's a Yeled. And then she talks to the women, the Jewish women, maybe you can help me so we can get someone to nurse this baby. So on and so forth. Person after person, personality after personality in this story, no names. None at all. What's the symbolism of that? And then, what happens? She brings the baby in, he gets nursed, he grows up in this woman's house, and she gives him a name. She gives him a name. Look at Pasuk Yud. Everybody look at Pasuk Yud. Vayigdal ha'yel v'tivyel v'paro v'hila levein v'tikra shemo Moshe. She names him Moshe. First name to appear in the story is the name Moshe. And she says, the reason why I'm giving you the name Moshe, v'tomer mikimin ha'mayim mishitiyu, because I drew him out of the water. And to draw from the water brings us to the name Moshe, which means to draw out. So you wonder to yourself, the Torah could have very simply put in the name, let's assume all the names that we know, that we think we know who these people are, Yocheved, Miriam, Amram, Batya, if that was her name, I don't know if that was her name. Others that are involved in the story, they could have been given their names in the story, but they're not here. And the story goes on. Moshe grows up. What happens? Moshe goes out and he sees, what does he see on the first day? People. Two Jews. Who are they? Do they have names? Maybe. But they're not given in the text. And the next day he goes out and there's an Egyptian man hitting a Jewish man. Do they have any names? None. And this whole story goes on. The seven daughters of Kohen Midian, right? The whole chapter 2 is the perek of nameless individuals. And the question is why? Let's turn to the second side here. We're not going to read this whole text. So I want to focus on the left column. It says on the top, page 79. This is from a writer who was a teacher of mine in yeshiva. When I was in Israel, he wrote a book on Parshat Shavua, and he has a beautiful comment where he describes what's taking place when the Jewish people go into slavery. So I'm reading here on the left column, and here's what he says. Perek Aleph, what happens in chapter 1 in the book of Shemot? Te'ur hashkia be'omek agalut. The people are deep in the depths of exile, of galut, of the slavery of Egypt. Melech Hadash, Vayavidu b'nei Yisrael b'farech, and he goes on, what happens in this slavery? People lose their identity, they lose their shame, they lose their ani. What's the ani? The ani is the unique aspect of each individual, which is totally eliminated when they get to Mitzrayim. Kulam osim oto davar, everybody has to wake up, put on the same uniform, go to the same pyramid, do the exact same type of work, 12 hours, 14 hours, every day, same thing, same, every day. What does that do to a person? What does that do to the individual? And they lose their sense of identity. Men had to do women's work, the Midrashim say, and women had to do men's work. What does that do to your sense of self? L'lo kol yichud minimali. There's not no aspect of specialness to the person. Filu zeshel gever l'mad isha. You can't even tell a man from a woman. They were doing the same type, the opposite types of work. Kal v'chomer shein yichud ishi shem. And he quotes here from Rav Kook. Rav Kook writes that one of the elements of being in galut, va'ani betoch ha'gola, in the galut, ha'ani ha'pnimi ha'atzmi, eno megale. What happens is the inner being that only I know to be me is not able to be revealed. It's in chains. It's enslaved. V'kevan she'ein ani, ein hu, kal v'chomer she'ein ata. And he goes on and he talks about Paro's plan to destroy the children, to murder the children. And then, what happens? There's no names. The whole identity is gone. And then all of a sudden, Pasuk Yud, we saw on the previous page, Moshe. And that's when the story starts to turn. When one person is given an opportunity to have an identity, he's given a mission to be able to give everybody else back their identity. The parasha ba'a, Moshe machil yifol, and he starts to go. That was this past week's parasha, right? Hashem comes to Moshe, you gotta go to Paro, you gotta get this story going. And remember, the first time Moshe comes to the people, and he tells them, hey guys, we're going to get out of here. It's going to end. It's going to all be over. What's the people's reaction? V'lo shamu el Moshe. They didn't listen. Why couldn't they listen? Mikotzer ruach mi'avadak hasha. They couldn't listen. They were beyond. They were beyond the ability to catch their breath physically, spiritually, emotionally, psychologically. They were done. And then they got angry because Paro made the work harder, and you have to get the same amount of bricks with less material, and you got to go. You all remember the story. Why did you come, Moshe? You made things worse. They don't want to listen to him. But he's persistent because Hashem is persistent. And Hashem is persistent with Moshe, so Moshe pushes and pushes, and then the Makot, and then we know how the story comes to an end. And that's exactly what's going on here in this story. So, we want to understand what it means to be a slave. We want to understand what it means to be free. There was an interview, you can turn to the next page, there was an interview with a social scientist by the name of Simon Sinek. Simon Sinek has written a number of books trying to explain things that go on in society. And he explains something that applies to every person in this room, including me, born after 1984. So we're all in the same group called millennials. You might have heard this phrase before, unless they're saying that people born after 2000-something are a different generation, but millennials. Millennials have a certain way about them. And in this talk, you can watch the whole clip. It's online. This is just a transcript. It is very interesting. And I want to just point out a few things that he says, because often we think of slavery as being in chains and, I don't know, sitting in a jail or building a pyramid, maybe in the Mitzrayim sense of the term. But we don't usually think of slavery as I'm sitting on my phone and I can't do anything else because I'm a slave to it.
They end in 1995.
Millennials end in 1995. So what's the next one called?
I don't know. Okay.
I'm
different.
No,
that's earlier. I'll have five more rounds. Okay, you can continue.
Okay. So here's what he says. I'm in the third paragraph here on the first on the page that says at the top transcript of the millennials. Apparently, millennials as a group of people, which are those born from approximately 1984 and after.
1996 to 2010 is Generation
Okay. Z. Okay. And after are tough to manage. Okay, so then I guess I'm in a league of my own. They are accused...
You're a millennial.
They are accused of being... Listen carefully.
You're a millennial.
Entitled, narcissistic, self-interested, unfocused, and lazy. But entitled is the big one. So you have an entire generation growing up, and he talks about this. He talks about this earlier in his discussion. He says they're growing up with lower self-esteem than previous generations through no fault of their own. They were dealt a bad hand. Now let's add in technology. Now this one I think applies even to people born after whatever the cutoff date you said was. So we know that engagement with social media and our cell phones releases a chemical in the brain called dopamine. That's when you get a text, right? It feels good. In a 2012 study, Harvard research scientists reported, talking about oneself through social media activates a pleasure sensation in the brain usually associated with food, money, and sex. It's why we count the likes. It's why we go back 10 times to see if the interaction is growing. And if our Instagram is slowing, we wonder if we've done something wrong or if people don't like us anymore. The trauma for young kids to be unfriended is too much to handle. So we know when you get the attention, it feels good. You get a hit of dopamine, which feels good, which is why we keep going back to it. Dopamine is the exact same chemicals, carefully, that makes us feel good when we smoke, when we drink, when we gamble. In other words, it's highly, highly addictive. Here's the powerful comment that he makes. We have age restrictions on smoking, drinking, gambling, but we have no age restrictions on social media and cell phones, which is the equivalent of opening up the liquor cabinet and saying to our teenagers, hey, by the way, if this adolescence thing gets you down, help yourself.
You're comparing social media to alcohol.
I'm not. Yes. An entire generation now... Entire generation now. This isn't him. This is science. This is science. He's quoting science. Has access to an addictive, numbing chemical called dopamine through self and social media while they're going through the high stress of adolescence. Now, pardon? Yeah, a lot of things. Turn to the next page. I want to show you a few more things he says here. So if you're sitting at dinner about... there's some arrows on the page, so follow me with the arrows. So if you're sitting at dinner with your friends and you're texting someone who's not there, that's a problem, he says. That's an addiction. I'll share with you a story. You will not appreciate this fully. You will not appreciate this story fully right now. But I want you, Liara, I want you to come back to me and tell me in, God willing, one day in the next few years, or whatever, in the future of your life, that you appreciate the story. You'll understand in a minute why, what I meant by that comment. Everyone in this room. I bless you with the blessing. You should one day appreciate the story the way I appreciate it. Okay? That's the blessing. Listen to the story. I have a very close... mentor, colleague, who I worked with for a number of years, not in this school, in a different school, and who no longer works in that school. He retired. He's in his 80s. He worked celebration, right? When they give the children their first sidur, their first chumash, and all the parents are there, and all the grandparents are there, and everybody shows up, and it's a big to do, and everybody comes with their cameras, and they want to take picture of their kid getting the sidur, and he gets up at the beginning. And he says, everybody, put your cameras away. Put your phones away. Put your cameras away. Hide them. Put them under your chair. Put them in your pocket. And just watch. Don't miss this experience by watching it from behind a screen. Watch it with your own eyes. There'll be opportunity to take a picture. There'll be opportunity. But don't miss the experience. And this is the point that he's making here. That's an addiction. If you're sitting in a meeting with people you're supposed to be listening and speaking to, or you're listening to a shiur, right? You put your phone on the table. It sends a subconscious message to the room. You're just not that important. Subconscious. Whether you intend it or not is irrelevant. The fact that you can't put it away... Why I added this in here, I'm hoping should be fairly obvious. Whether you agree or you disagree with everything he says is not the point. You're allowed to disagree. He's not the expert on everything. But the perspective, I think, is very interesting and maybe a little bit shocking when you hear it. that you could be a slave to something without actually having cuffs on your hands and being physically stuck in one place that you can't get out of. You could be a slave up here. You could be a slave up here or here, right? That's up to you to decide if that's where you are. When we think about chirut, what is freedom? Here are some perspectives on this from the three thinkers that I mentioned at the beginning. And after these three thinkers, we'll wrap up. So we'll start with Viktor Frankl. You can turn the page. Viktor Frankl, Dr. Viktor Frankl, Holocaust survivor, was a very, very, very important person in Holocaust literature. He wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. He was born in Vienna. He also died in Vienna. He went there after the war. And he was a psychotherapist. He was a scientist. He was a researcher. He developed a type of therapy. He actually developed it partly while he was in an inmate in one of the concentration camps called Theresienstadt. You might have heard of it. And his role while he was there in this camp, he was one of the camp doctors. He worked in one of the clinics for basically people who were suffering from different types of mental health. It's not what they called it then, but people who were suffering from all kinds of different ailments, but mostly mental types of issues. And he had a very strong experience, powerful experience interacting with these different people. And he came up with basically a guaranteed way of surviving, but he came up with a formula through which he understood how a lot of people were able to get through the experiences of concentration camp, of the war. And it comes down to one point, and here's what he says. I have two quotes here. One is on page 50. It says page 5 at the bottom, but it's page 50 in the photocopy. And it's on the left side. So he writes like this. And by the way, this book is very short. If you've never read it, I really, really recommend it.
What's it called?
Man's Search for Meaning. Man's Search for Meaning. Okay? You can read it in like 2 hours. It's just like 80, 90 pages, the whole thing. Yeah. They're short pages. They're like really short. It's a small book. Small little book.
Oh, is this like one page?
Yeah. Yeah. See how fast you can read one and then multiply it by. Okay. Under the influence of a world which no longer recognizes the value of human life and human dignity, he's writing based on experience during the Holocaust. And he says, the value of human life and human dignity which had robbed man of his will and had made him an object to be exterminated, under this influence, skip the parentheses, the personal ego finally suffered a loss of values. If the man in the man concentration camp did not struggle against this in a last effort to save his self-respect, think about what we said right at the beginning of this discussion, he lost the feeling of being an individual, a being with a mind, with inner freedom and personal value. He thought of himself then as only a part of an enormous mass of people. His existence descended to the level of animal life. Okay? Think about the idea of identity, of a shame, of the name being erased. And as many survivors speak about, when they were given their number, their name no longer existed. Turn the page on the left side, page 76. As we said before, any attempt to restore man's inner strength in the camp had first to succeed in showing him some future goal. Nietzsche's words, he who has a why to live for can bear with almost any how. In other words, if you have a goal, if you have a mission, if you have something to hang on to, if you wake up in the morning and you have a reason why you're here in this world, you'll be a lot more successful in that day than if you wake up and you feel like you have no purpose in this world and you have no reason to be here. And it's scary because a lot of people in this world wake up that way. So think about that. And that's what he's saying. That was how he understood how a lot of people actually made it through the war, because they were able to be free in their minds even though they weren't free physically. So chirut, being free, is not just a physical idea. And that's the point that he's making here. If you skip down a few lines to the next underline, woe to him who saw no more sense in his life, no aim, no purpose, and therefore no point in carrying on. He was soon lost. Typical reply with which such a man rejected all encouraging arguments was, I have nothing to expect from life anymore. What sort of answer can one give to that? What was really needed was a fundamental change in our attitude toward life. We had to learn, top of 77, and furthermore, to learn ourselves, and furthermore, we had to teach the despairing men, it did not really matter what we expected from life, but rather what life expected from us. Powerful words from Dr. Viktor Frankl. Let's turn and look at a thought from Rav Kook. Rav Kook wrote a commentary on the Haggadah, and one of his big themes in his commentary is freedom. So we're not going to read this whole thing, just where you see the arrow there on the left side on page 173. Very, very important line. It says, the difference between slave and free man is not just one of social standing. Meaning, just because you have chains on your hands doesn't necessarily make you more of a slave than the person who doesn't have chains on his or her hands. It's possible to find an educated slave whose spirit is full of freedom, and conversely, a free man whose spirit is servile. We all know people like that. Maybe some of them are all of us, a little bit. A little bit. A little bit of us is a slave to something. What is characteristic of freedom? Here's his point. Is the exalted spirit whereby a person or people is able, faithful, to his inner essence, the image of Hashem in his midst. And this spirit of being a slave is the opposite. That everything that you do, I was just using technology as one example, but we can think of so many examples. The way that we dress, and when I say dress, doesn't mean you're supposed to, you know, not look presentable. But how are you deciding that? Is your decision based on what everybody else is doing, or is the decision based on you? How much of it is influenced by others and what you see and what the world tells you should look at, what society tells you should look like, etc. Fill in the blank to the things that we all think we have to be like because society decided that's what we should be like. This celebrity, that celebrity. That's Rav Kook's point. To truly be free, is to be able to internally be able to make decisions without being influenced by the pressures that are outside of us. And we'll just end with a story on the last page. Natan Sharansky, who's one of the heroes of the Jewish people of our generation. For those who know his story, it's another book. It's a lot longer of a read, so I'm not going to push you to read it right now. Fear No Evil, but it is something you should read. So two books from tonight, Man's Search for Meaning, Fear No Evil. Really, really important, what I would call pretty much obligatory reading for a Jew in this generation to appreciate where you are. Because there are, anybody here have family from Russia, Soviet Union? Okay? Some people here? So you know a little bit of that history maybe? Jews weren't so... Being Jewish there wasn't so easy for pretty much the better of the last 100 years. And there were a lot of Jews who were trying to get out of the Soviet Union because they were trying to get to Israel, they were trying to get to America. Different stories. One of the leaders of this group, his name was Natan Anatoly Sharansky. He was arrested in 1977. He was arrested in 1977 on two charges. First charge was treason. Treason. They thought he was trying to topple the government, whatever. And the second one was they accused him of spying. They accused Natan Sharansky of spying, and he was sentenced to a long time in prison, but not like nice prison where they have cable and dafyomi and, you know, minyan. There are prisons like that. Shabbos food, kosher food, you know. There's prisons like that. It's crazy to think, but Unfortunately, there's Jews in jail today. So it wasn't like that. Okay, Natsuratsky was sent to the Gulag. Heard of that? It's in Siberia. It's in the middle of nowhere. It's freezing. There's nothing to eat. It's horrible conditions. And he was there for 13 years. 13 years. But he was given an opportunity to speak. He was given an opportunity to not argue why he should be innocent, because they weren't going to listen to him, but just to give your last words, you know? So right before he was sent off to the Gulag, and he got out in 1990, and it was a whole story, and the President of the United States was involved. Fear no evil. Read the book if you want to know more. I know I'm getting people excited about it. I don't want to give away the whole story. So he stands up in the court, and he turns to the judge, and here's the story I'm reading here on the last page. After Natan Sharansky, it's in the bottom half where it's boxed off. After Natan Sharansky was sentenced to Siberia, he addressed the judge, and he said, "Your Honor, you think you are free. Know that of the two of us, I am he who is truly free. My body, may be enslaved, but my spirit remains free. For I know I have not succumbed to your decrees. I remain true to my faith." And for anyone who knows the story, while Natan Sharansky was in jail, he was able to pretty much get everything he wanted. He tricked them. He was able to celebrate holidays. He was able to get a Tehillim, and he was saying Tehillim all day, and all kinds of other things that he was able to pull off. "You, Your Honor, were told how to rule. I'm on the left side in advance of this trial. Your body may be free, but you are not free to rule in accordance with your beliefs. Your spirit is enslaved, and that is far more severe. Now more than ever," and remember, this is on the eve of him going into this very long period, and he didn't know it was 13 years. It could have been forever. He got released after 13 years. He went in there for life. "I am distant from my people. Many difficult years of imprisonment lie ahead of me. Now more than ever, I turn to my wife Avital and to my people, saying, L'shana haba'a b'Yerushalayim habnuya." Amazing that a person on the eve of going into such a dark point of his life was able to feel true freedom. Freedom, which is something that can never be taken away from us. So next time we think we live in 2017, we live in a society with religious freedom, we're able to go to shul on Shabbat, we're able to go to a Jewish high school, we're able to learn Torah, we're able to practice our religion freely. Of course we're free. What about my life is not free? Right? I'm able to go where I want, to shop where I want, to do what I want. But think for a minute about the things that we have in our life that are a little bit of us not being us. A little bit of us trying to be too much like society telling us to be something else. That is the danger of slavery in 2017. And that's something that these parshiot continue to call to us. What it means to be really, really, truly free. To be a bat chorin, to be a free person. And that's something that we're going to remain as a challenge. We're going to leave as a question for the evening and for the rest of the semester. And I wish everybody a wonderful evening.